All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. Just real quick to tell you sort of how this is going to work. All of our presentations are going to be 10 minutes long. And also our slides are auto-generating, so we won't be able to, we'll have to kind of time it just right. So if you see us being a little bit off on our timings, it's not because we're partied out or anything like that. It's just this is how it's going to work. So we have no net here. So if the folks in the back, would you mind just going ahead and giving me my 10 minutes? Thank you. All right. So the reason this talk came about was that prior to my position I'm at now, I was a lower middle manager at Microsoft, and I was talking to one of the designers on my team. And they had asked me for some feedback on a project, and the feedback I gave them was, we should make this more delightful. And they looked at me, and I realized that I had just given the equivalent of make the logo bigger or put everything above the fold. So it made me kind of go back, think a little bit, and say, well, what is a delightful experience? And what I really figured out was that there were some of these, there are these characteristics of what makes something a delightful experience. And we have them listed here. This is definitely not a comprehensive list, but we'll talk about these. Now, the thing is, you see one of them. It's subtlety is a good characteristic of a delightful experience. And I want to show you something that, well, isn't so subtle. This is lingscars.com. This is actually a real website. Mr. Ling has designed this and developed it himself. He doesn't attend MIC, so he doesn't get a lot of good UX skill sets. But he actually, those are pictures of him shooting Gaddafi with a paint gun. Designers all the time are telling him, like, hey, do you know that people use your website as an example of bad design? And he will actually argue with you and tell you, no, my site has won an award. And we're all kind of trying to figure out what that award is. But that's what I would call an undelightful design. So what I'm going to try to do is spend the rest of the time talking about what are some delightful experiences that are out there on the web today. Now, when we talk about delightful experiences, typically the one company that always comes up is a company called MailChimp at MailChimp.com. And what they've always done is they've always put kind of UX in the forefront. And what MailChimp does is they're responsible for email campaigns and newsletters. So a lot of times if you're getting a really well-designed newsletter, it's probably from these folks. And what's kind of cool is that they've thought about delightful experiences. And one of the characteristics that we talk about is human-centric design. And one of the things they do is they think about people as humans and that, hey, they need help getting through things like setting up a system. So here, for example, instead of just throwing a CAPTCHA at you and saying, hey, you figure out what this CAPTCHA is all about, they actually explain, hey, this is what the CAPTCHA is for, and what we want to do is we want you to go ahead and hit that confirm sign up button once you're done filling in the CAPTCHA, and we know that you're actually a human being. Now, one of the kind of cool things that they do is that when you're getting set up, they actually tell people how long it's going to take. I don't know how many of y'all have ever filled out something and it says it'll only take a few moments and you wonder, well, how long is a moment actually? And they'll tell you, hey, it's going to take about 30 seconds. So you're like, oh, well, 30 seconds, I've got time for that. But then they do something that I just think is great. Most of the time when I fill out these things, they ask me like, hey, how many people are in your company? What kind of, business are you? And you feel like you're getting interrogated so that they can send you more spam and things. Well, what they'll do is they'll actually tell you why they do it. So here, for example, you say, this is the industry that I'm a part of. And they say, okay, well, what we're going to do is we'll measure your performance against other people's performance in your industry. So it makes people feel confident that, like, oh, okay, you're not going to spam me with this stuff, but you're actually doing it for a reason. Now, another thing I really love about MailChimp is the fact that they add whimsy to their website via their mascot, the chimp. And so the chimp, whenever you log in, will tell you different things depending on when you log in and time and things like that. And like one of the things he'll do is he'll say, "Why am I smiling?" you ask. "Because I'm not wearing any pants." And he'll say things all the time. And like for example, one time I logged in and he said, "Thomas, I'd like to have a little talk with you." And the amazing part was, I totally wanted to find out what he was going to tell me. And I was so excited. And then what happened? He actually Rickrolled me. I couldn't believe it. It was crazy. So this is kind of cool because they've kind of taken this whimsical thing and made it sort of part of the DNA of the website. But I know what happens a lot of times when I start talking about MailChimp and mascots and kind of fun stuff is, but Thomas, I work for an enterprise. We can't do these whimsical, purple mushrooms and things flying around and stuff like that. We've got to be boring and have battleship gray forms. And what I always say to this is that, well, maybe you're not going to have some whimsical mascot like MailChimp does, but there are things that you can focus in on, different characteristics of a good experience, and kind of focus in on those things. So one of the things that I always recommend that people do, whether it be an enterprise line of business system or even a well-trafficked website, is to think of things like, again, being human-centric, making sure that people feel comfortable going through your process, making sure that things are very, very simple and easy to use. And then another thing is look at the details. Because what we see is that when people care about all the details, I will say 99.9% of the time, the overall experience is going to be delightful. And you don't need a monkey without pants to prove that. Now, I totally recommend this blog. It's called littlebigdetails.com. And what they do is they basically show you just these little snippets of these little details that just kind of make an experience just a little more delightful, a little bit better. And the funny part is these things probably will never be in a top 10 list on a product guide. Or it's not going to be something that you're going to see in a keynote like you saw this morning. That it's really going to be about just that small thing that you probably didn't even notice was there. Much, much more subtle than what we saw, of course, with Mr. Ling and his lingcars.com. Another great website is TripIt.com. And the reason why I like them so much is because they actually take the mundane and exploit it. So whenever I do travel booking and things like that, this is the email that I get back from our travel agency at Microsoft. You get this kind of very text-driven thing with a lot of verbiage and stuff. And then what they do is they simply put a PDF in there for you. Now, usually if I wanted to be a cool Web 2.0 kid and put things in some kind of trip application, I would have to actually put in all the information myself. What TripIt does is it takes that nasty-looking, horrible experience of putting in information into a website. All you do is you just send your email to them. They decompose it, and then they put it on the site for you. It's magical. It really is. I'm always amazed because I send them the craziest stuff, and they just figure it out. And what's cool is that they just make it happen. And again, exploiting the mundane is a really cool thing to do, even if you're not, dealing with monkeys and no pants. Now, finally, I want to talk about an anti-pattern that gets a lot of people when they start thinking about this stuff. Because a lot of times people go, wouldn't it be cool if I had a color picker that would spin the globe and then I would pick a country and then it would give me the colors that are most used in that country. And it's like, I just wanted to pick a font for my Word document. So what happened to is that I read a really good article by a guy that is a friend of mine, Joshua Allen, and he wrote this article in UX Magazine about transients. And he said, transform your normal experience into something stunning and memorable, but make sure that normal things can still be done. So the thing that we always have to think about, whether we have flying butterflies on our website or we're trying to do anything, is that at the end of the day, someone is coming to our website, to our operating system, to our application to do a certain particular thing. And we got to make sure that whatever we come up with to be delightful still stays focused and lets them do that. So what I want to do is leave you with those things. Think about the characteristics of delightful experiences. Incorporate those characteristics into the experiences that you're creating. Then go out, create delightful experiences, and then even more important for me, would you send me on Twitter, at Tommy Lee, the delightful experiences that you've built, because I'd love to get them together and show other people about it. Thank you.
Are we ready? Hi, everyone. My name is August, and I'm a designer and a part-time professor. And I live and work in Seattle, Washington. About 6 months ago, I went through what my friends called a quarter-life crisis, which is kind of like a midlife crisis, but for overachievers. And instead of buying a sports car or dating one of my students, I chose a third option. I became a consultant. So what I did is I quit my job, ending a 7.5-year tenure at Microsoft, and I joined a strategic design firm called Artifact, where we do a lot of cool and amazing things. Part of my job there is to help articulate the vision for the company, and this vision is in the form of a manifesto. And I'm not going to talk about the details of this manifesto today, but rather I'm going to talk about some of the foundational ideas in the form of a first glimpse, some of the ideas that inform this manifesto. And even though this is a vision for the company, if you recall what Emerson said in the essay, Self-Reliance, to believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, well, that is genius. So it's not so much a vision for the company, but a vision for the industry at large. And the name for this vision, it's kind of grandiose. I call it 21st Century Design. So I'd like to begin by talking about the work of Stephen Shaviro, who wrote the introduction to this British science fiction novel called Universe of Things by Gwyneth Jones. And this story is set in the near future, and the Earth has been invaded by these aliens. And these aliens aren't nasty or violent. They're not even unpleasant. In fact, they're these kind of genderless, effeminate creatures that just live among us. And the thing is, humans feel diminished by their presence, even though they're kind of innocuous, and it's because they possess superior technology. In fact, these aliens use tools that are alive, kind of like in the Flintstonian cosmology, where they use animals. Yeah, I said Flintstonian cosmology. All right, so if we think about tools from a human perspective, we create these things that are made out of raw materials, and we think of them as inanimate objects, which supports the idea that we're somehow separate from our context. While our alien neighbors, on the other hand, they kind of grow their tools out of bacteria. And these tools are chemically encoded so that they can store and communicate feelings and memories. And so these aliens are always connected, not only to each other, but to the environment in which they live. In fact, so much so that the whole idea of being apart is completely unknown to them. Well, this is an allegory. This story is an allegory for where we are today with media and technology. And it actually supports the thesis by media critic Marshall McLuhan that all media are prosthetic extensions of ourselves. And here's a really subtle yet important implication, that we don't necessarily use tools. Rather, we have to work with tools. And what this suggests is that alignment between a user or a person and the tools or the system that they're engaged in is more important than usability. Or another way of saying it is that learnability is more important than discoverability. And this is a design principle that's already in practice in like video games, where if a player has to resort to consulting a user manual, well, the experience is already shot. But these qualities of alignment and learnability and adaptability are all qualities of really good natural user interfaces as well. And even though NUIs aren't necessarily the most efficient way of doing things, they're by far the most aligned. And I bring this up because my second to last role at Microsoft was Director of User Experience for Microsoft Surface. And I'm really happy to see that there's a big presence with Surface at Mix this year. And one thing I saw, especially in the early days, was this tendency for designers and developers to just think of Surface as GUI on a table, that they just slap GUI controls and think about the hands and touch as a proxy for the mouse. And in fact, this shouldn't be strange because when GUIs were first introduced, teams often thought of the mouse as a proxy for the arrow keys. But why is the mouse less aligned? Well, it's kind of appropriate that we're in Las Vegas for this discussion, because if you think about the mechanics of a mouse, it's like placing a series of bets. And the moment you click on the mouse button, you kind of cross this point of no return. The all bets are in, and that you've found yourself engaged in this zero-sum game where if you just happen to make the wrong choice, you're kind of screwed. You have this emotional negative response. And I argue it's the characteristics of the mouse that why so many people still find computing intimidating today. While NUI, on the other hand, is fluid, it's organic, it's adaptable. In other words, NUI's aligned to the way we behave already, and it also allows us to align our behavior to it. And this kind of alignment removes this intimidation factor, and it also creates a kind of neutral to positive emotional response. So if we go back to these two systems of tools, and we give them fancy names, the contextualist system thinks of us as separate from the tools, while the alien organicist system thinks of us as part of a continuum with the tools. And we find that GUI and its predecessors are more contextualist, and that NUI and the things that are to come are more organicist. But here's the thing. When you take the aliens out of the picture, what you find is exactly where we are as an industry today, at this crossroads. And here's the point. So if you recall in the story that we are intimidated by these new technologies, we as aliens, and that's because humans are no longer the measure of all things. That what this marked was a departure from the human-centric framework of technology. And here's the very real design implication that we could all take back with us from here. It's that whether we like it or not, we are departing from user-centric approaches to design. In other words, the days of user-centered design are numbered. And as new models of interaction and new technologies emerge, well, user-centered design will become increasingly irrelevant. So, if you think about it, every pillar of modern thought is marked by a departure from a human-centric system. For example, Copernicus showed that we're no longer the center of the galaxy, and that Darwin showed that we're just yet another species on the planet. Even Freud said that humans aren't even the center of ourselves, that we're driven by impulses that were formed by childhood events that indelibly shape who we are. Whether you believe Freud or not, it remains to be seen that today there is a growing evidence base in fields such as behavioral economics and cognitive psychology and neuroscience that show that we as a species, we as humans, are terrible at articulating what it is that makes us happy, why those things make us happy, when the last time we were happy, and the events that led up to that point in time. So why on earth would we put such an unreliable narrator, such a source of misinformation, at the center of our design process? All right. So I'm not making the case for ignoring users. That would be short-sighted. What I am making the case for is we rethink design approaches, that we pay more attention to understanding human motivation, that the presentation of choices affects their outcome, that we prioritize actual needs over desires, whether they're perceived or otherwise, that we write explicit goals about the emotional impact that a product or service has on a user, and also that we strive for systems that are more learnable and more adaptable rather than efficient or usable, which is still appropriate in some situations. And finally, that we abandon approaches that have shown historically, at best, only incremental improvement. The reason why I'm raising this is because we're only at the very beginning of understanding the true power of design. And to help illustrate just how nascent we are in this industry, let me present this metaphor. Imagine if doctors were only allowed to style people's hair or put on makeup, even though their knowledge, skills, expertise would allow them to perform surgery, fight disease, save lives. That's kind of an analogy where the design industry is today. But in order to break away from that, we need to start challenging the status quo in ways that are thoughtful, meaningful, and rational. And in doing so, I believe that we'll begin to realize the true power and ability of our profession, and ultimately usher in a new age, that of 21st century design. Thank you.
All right, how do I follow that? Thank you, August, that was awesome. but somebody has to, so I'll give it a go. Everyone, thanks so much for coming to the Lightning Talks, and thanks to everybody at Microsoft for putting it together. I'm Corey Schumann, I'm a consultant at Sorlight MVP who focuses on user experience. Today I'm here to talk to you about touch, kind of where we are with touch. But to talk about touch, we first need to talk about the mouse, because we use it every day. And since we use it for since almost 40 years, that technology wasn't there at the beginning to actually touch. So we had to make do with what we had, and that is the mouse. So whenever you go to a computer or workstation or even a laptop and you're using the mouse, there's a bias of you're actually starting to work with a computer. And as August alluded to, that there's some intimidation and there's also a little trepidation of users coming in to work with computers because you're still working with computers. So there's obviously an evolution of trying to solve this problem of touch interfaces, but there's an innate problem with these is that they're still in the software used mouse clicks. So as I'm touching a kiosk, it's still registering the software registered as mouse clicks. So, you know, kiosks at the airport that we all checked in at, ATMs, and I think one of the first memories that I have was about 10 years ago at Starbucks, and the person behind the counter was actually reading the order. And it's just something so simple, but you're starting this natural progression of touching interfaces. So we move on. Technology evolved, and products like, in about the past 5 years, products like the Microsoft Surface started to come around. Research, tons of walls, people were building their own. Somebody in the back who's built his own. But it really wasn't accessible. These things aren't mobile, they're not cost effective, and really didn't engage the user. So, because the software wasn't as tight. I mean, the Surface was amazing. It picked up all your fingers. And so this was like our first true handshake that we had with the user in saying, like, we're listening to you, a touch is a touch, instead of a touch is a mouse click. So we further move on, and we package all these things up, put it in our pocket with a CPU and GPU, and there are computers in our pocket, but the user is experiencing them in a very, very different way. So what I propose is that we're at the very early stages of a touch renaissance. And with that touch renaissance, we're here as software creators, as ambassadors and pioneers in this space. Sure, there's been a trend in the past 3 years, and I might almost feel like that we're past it, but really we're at the very beginning of this period. So we kind of have this like responsibility to our users, because they're approaching these devices not as computers, they're not using a mouse, they're approaching them as like more natural user interface, newly, and they're touching them. There's this real different sensation that they have. So everything that's been out there, I don't really need to introduce the devices that I'm talking about here. I'm talking about phones, and then in the next couple of years, there's going to be a tremendous influx of tablets. In fact, I see a lot more tablets here than I was expecting. So it's an opportunity for us to take note and pause for a second and think, are there projects that you're working on that touch could be used, or start thinking about touch for the future of your applications? So just tremendous amount of technology and time and effort. And I guess the question here is, does touch really matter? Is it really that much different than a mouse? And up into the kiosks, no, I mean, it wasn't. I was touching multi-touch. It's not too different. But I would argue that it's tremendously different. And it's so different that because we're born with touch. We come out, we feel even before we see. And so since we have that natural instinct to touch, it's one of our senses, children explore the world through touch. We're simply tactile creatures. You know, if we hold a blanket and see a kid hold, I don't know if you've had a blankie, but hold it, like you hold it and you feel it and you smell it, and I'm getting a lot of feedback. And so you feel it, and you're like, explore that. Conversely, if you've seen children touch things, touch walls in airports and play, and then they put something in their mouth, you're like, no, don't do it. But they're exploring the world. And so even as adults, though, we use touch to feel and explore our world. And so this brings us back to software, and it's not really surprising that touch is coming back into software and why it's so important. And it's because right now with the devices that we've seen, they're very personal, and it's a very personal experience. And we touch and feel the screen that we're using on our phone, and it feels elegant, it feels soft and smooth. And not only that, but the software as it is today is giving us that feedback of helping us out. So something that we really don't talk about too much in software design is emotion. Like, what's the emotional impact that you have? And so with a mouse, there's still that distance, but when you're actually touching that interface, whether we like it or not, the person is emoting, and how does your software affect your users? Does it make them calm, anxious, annoyed? I'm sure I've gotten that one a few times, and as well as pleasant. It's a very pleasant experience. So how do you harness that kind of emotion? And it's through UX. And when designing for touch, you need to not think of designing for a mouse. Rather, you need to design for touch. And so UX is absolutely paramount. Sure, design, don't get me wrong, design is the way that we're going to be engaged with the user. And then software development is going to help us maintain this. But really and truly, UX is paramount, and it needs to be thought of. It's better to have a simple, usable application rather than something that looks fantastic that nobody can use. How do you use animations? How do you use transitions? They should be natural and feel natural. And if you're not really sure if animation or motion really isn't kind of your foray, take cues from the leaders in the industry that have invested tremendous amounts of time and money in focus groups and study this and over and over again, because they have they're starting to bring what they're learning back from touch back into their operating systems. So we can speculate with OS X, there's been announcements of bringing touch into the DNA, and we can probably speculate that Windows 8 is also going to have that baked into the DNA as well, or hopefully. And so this enables us to create software for touch and for the future. So really, what's next after we have the touch enabled in the software? And it was really kind of up to us. I know that I hate that answer, but really it is. We're here on this touch renaissance, about to enter in this influx of tablets and see touch on our desktops. So conceptually, we can think about touch on walls. We can think about walking into our kitchen and refrigerator and touching and getting the grocery list. This is all very, very conceptual, right? It affects us and our everyday projects because the devices are going to be there. The software is going to be there so we can have that personal connection with our user. So really, it's totally open. It's an open road kind of for software and for us to create awesome experiences. And I hope that you take UX seriously and really kind of embrace the touch phenomenon and be part of the touch renaissance. Thanks.
Am I mic'd up? We got 10 seconds on the clock there, or 10 seconds, 10 minutes. Do we want to reset real quick? So, my name's Chris. I was going to call this I Don't Have to Go After August. I'm a designer. I've been trained as a designer. I've worked as a designer. But I started off wanting to be a filmmaker, and that's what I went to school about the first time. And I want to share something about this guy. His name's John Hughes. He's a film director. And as George Lucas is to Star Wars, John Hughes is to teen comedies. And by thinking adjacently, which is kind of a brainstorming exercise we can do, we can derive insights from other disciplines and industries that can help us be a better designer and developer. Now, John Hughes died at 59, 2009. He was visiting his kids in New York, and he had a heart attack on a sidewalk and died. And I don't want to dwell on his death as much as how he lived his life, because it's really important, some of the things that he did and what some of his characters did. And when he died, it impacted me in a big way, and it forced changes in my own life, and I want to share what some of those are with you, because I think you're going to derive value from them too. And if you want to be a 21st century designer, I think some of the things that I'm going to talk about will show you, starting with this. And it's the core theme.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
So sometimes we're so busy, we miss everything, right? Half of us are tweeting this versus paying attention and listening to me right now, right? And if that's the core theme, the title of our book, Five Ideas are the chapters that we have. And if we think about chapters, we could ask this.
The question isn't what are we going to do, the question is what aren't we going to do.
Now the first concept is vision. And vision isn't really about knowing all the answers, it's about direction and accountability. It's about knowing what you want to do and taking a stab at figuring out how you're going to do it. And what it helps you do is not solve the wrong problem, right? Which is what we all want to do as designers and developers. But we solve wrong problems all the time, don't we?
Now, what can I do to help?
Well, you could finish the French toast.
Good.
I'll just open the donuts.
Good thinking.
Whoops. Don't lose the nails.
Just wait till I hear from you, then.
Voila! Breakfast is ready.
Now, as designers, when we don't have a vision, what do? We create beautiful crap. And as developers, we spend thousands of hours building things that somebody might not use. Vision helps keep us on the path, right? It's integrities and values that we have that enable us to do a better job. And when you don't have it, what are you really? You're a vendor.
Never had one lesson.
Now, another concept is sketching, which is kind of the cousin to journaling and writing. Sketching is one of the most important things you can do to unlock the creative process. And it's certainly something that John Hughes did, and he did it around personal excellence, and he also journaled. And it helps us understand creative insight. Now, what's interesting about sketching, and I'm sure some of you know this in this room, our brains are wired to understand sketches. This is how cognition works in our head. And sometimes we use too much complexity to do things when really a sketch will solve something easier for us. And we're going to do a test. See if you can guess what this next picture is that a colleague of mine, Sarah Summers, drew. I want to see if you can figure it out and understand what it is. Santa? Does it look like Santa Claus? Most people thought holiday or Santa Claus, right? Illustrations immediately let us grok what is going on. And this is important because we have new technology now that can take this power of sketching in speed and let me apply it to technology and design. Because what's the best way to have a great idea? It's to have 100 of them, right? And work through them till I get to the right one. And if I build everything in a painstaking way and process, I just can't get to that good idea. I get too attached to my bad ideas because I've got way too much invested in them. And this is where simple processes and practices combined with some new tools that we have can help us get better at what we do.
He'll keep calling me. He'll keep calling me until I come home. He'll make me feel guilty. This is ridiculous, okay? I'll go. Shit. God damn it!
Now, I hate planning. I think it blows. But you can't ignore it, because if you do, then you don't really know when you can ignore it. It helps you drive towards your vision. And this is important. John Hughes actually had a start as a copy director back in the day. And he had a cool employer. He said, do your job and follow your passions. He also had a job in New York as a copywriter for National Lampoon. And he would go into the office, do his job, leave a cup of coffee on the table, go to O'Hare, actually fly to New York and work on the National Lampoon at the same time. And what did this enable? It enabled a miracle to occur. And that miracle is someone bought one of his stories, and one of those stories became a movie you may have heard of called Vacation. A film career was born, right? Now, miracles can happen to us, too, when we think of software and design. And it's important to understand how that may happen. We do hard technical things. And I want to look back to a guy named Bill Buxton to kind of inspire us. This is actually from his book, Sketching for User Experience. And it's really talking about how the weight of criteria and the effort you put into things should be more the farther along the process. We all know this, right? We all do this. But I'm going to submit that not enough of us do fast, rapid iteration in the front to get to the right ideas. And when you do that, and then you cut over to the hard stuff later on, that's where miracles occur. Because when I start doing the hard things, I'm actually starting to do it with the right idea. But it's hard to do when we code up everything from square one and we get attached and fall in love with things.
Ted, won't we get pounded if we go to a senior party?
We got $70 and we got a pair of girls' underpants. We're safe as kittens, okay? This is a great social opportunity for us. Come on. Be polite to his parents, all right?
So probably one of the core themes of this whole track today is how important curiosity is in terms of what it can do for you. And curiosity allows those insights in those big ideas that we just can't get on our own. Now, John Hughes got married at a young age. He loved music. He was notorious for the you wanted the iPod or the mixtape that John Hughes would give you. And he had more in common with the students that he was growing up with than he did with his neighbors. And this led to some profound insights from him, from teenagers, which is the best day and the worst day of your life could both be in the same day. And he provided a voice to a whole generation that felt like baby boomers were kind of sucking the oxygen out of the air. And this provided an entire career in storytelling for him, and it probably impacted a lot of you in this room. I know it impacted me, and it inspired me to do things that I had ignored for a long time, like buying a camera and returning to passions that I started thinking about 20 years ago.
Cameron, what have you seen today?
Nothing good.
nothing? This, what do you mean, nothing good? We've seen everything good. We've seen the whole city. Uh-huh. We went to a museum, we saw priceless works of art. We ate pancreas.
So this last one is actually very important. Mentoring is probably the single most important endeavor that you can do in your life. Any profession. Doesn't even matter if it's design or development. And one of the things that John Hughes did that was interesting is when they were cleaning out a lot of his journals and letters, and he had boxes and boxes of them, is they found that he had written letters to all of his grandchildren every year so they could open up something. This may sound like the height of narcissism to you, but to me, it sounds like a wonderful gift that he gave his family because he was taken away too soon. And he did that with an entire generation of people, both people he worked with and people that he touched through his work. And I hope you understand that things as mundane as a teen comedy can provide insights that can help us live better lives as well.
What is so dangerous about a character like Ferris Bueller is he gives good kids bad ideas. Last thing I need at this point in my career is 1,500 Ferris Bueller disciples running around these halls. He jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern this student body.
Well, makes you look like an ass is what he does, Ed.
Thank you, Grace. I think you're wrong.
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads. They all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
So, I want you tomorrow morning, when you're looking at your drink or your cup of coffee, to ask yourself some questions. Ponder, do you have a vision? Do you have a plan to get there and address that vision? Are you employing guiding principles and skills, like maybe sketching a curiosity to get there? And are you taking someone along the way to get there as well? Because if you want to be a 21st century designer, if you want to do the things that everybody talked about here, these five things are actually going to help you be able to do it. So I hope you enjoyed this 40 minutes with the four of us. We all loved being up here, and we loved telling these great stories with you. And we'd actually like you to stick around. We'll keep talking after this, as long as you want to talk to us. But now we're done. It's over. Go. Thank you.